Hello, I'm Dino Congonitis. This is number 0611, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0611. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, NASA expert Rod Pyle is back on to talk about the success and future of the current Mars mission, including the first helicopter on another planet.
Yeah, what a moment, you know? I mean, all these years, and I kind of had my head in the Mars helicopter space since about 2014. All these years of anticipating, wondering, will it fly, will it not, will it work, will it not? I mean, they just make it look so damned easy.
Ross Hall, who operates Dying Art in New Zealand, on the extremely creative caskets he produces. How did this company start?
It all happened about 18 years ago when I was doing my will. I sort of went to myself, I don't really want to go out in a brown box. I think I've had a little bit more of a colorful life than that. I thought a little bit about it, and I wrote in my will that I wanted a red box with flames on it because I think I know where I'm going to end up. It sort of resonated with me, and when I can't be the only person out there that wants something a little different on the way out.
Sean Tyler Foley, author of The Power to Speak Naked. Where did the title of this book come from?
It actually came about, I was putting the book together and we didn't have a title and I was waffling over them and some people were taught, and I asked in a group of friends one evening, and I said, what's some of the advice that you guys have for speaking? And they said, well, you know, picture the audience naked. And I went off on this rant about how it's the worst advice ever and that I would rather empower somebody to speak naked than have them picturing an audience naked, that they should have the power within themselves to speak naked. And all of a sudden everybody went, that's the title of the book.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you that this was show number 0611 was Dino Congonitis. That's a name, by the way, that you just love to sing over and over again in a conga line. Dino Congonitis is also a freelance cameraman and video editor at MotionEdge.com. And back in the day when I was an anchor at Global News, he was one of the finest camera people that I had an opportunity to work with. Thank you very much, Dino, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? In Taiwan, where companies are required to give newlyweds 8 days of paid leave, an unnamed bank employee in Taipei used a loophole in the law to claim 32 days of leave over 37 days last year. The man and his wife got married 4 times and divorced 3 times, claiming 8 days of leave for each wedding. The bank complained to the city labor department, which sided with the employee and fined the bank about $670 for violating the regulation, sparking public criticism. The labor department later revoked the fine to recognize a mistake and improve, it said. Wow. Talk about gaming the system. You know, if this couple could get married just one more time, they could start an ABBA cover band. Meanwhile, we have another story of a guy who earned even more time off. An unnamed civil servant in Italy is accused of collecting full pay at his job at a hospital in Catanzaro since 2005, even though he never showed up for work. The man is also accused of threatening his supervisor if she filed a report against him. She later retired, and none of her successors noticed his absence. The BBC reported authorities discovered the alleged fraud as part of a wider investigation into absenteeism in Italy's public sector, and six managers at the hospital are also under investigation. The truant worker reportedly collected about $650,000 over the years. You know, there is nothing civil or servant-like about this civil servant. I'd like to know how he's been passing the time for the last 16 years. Okay, this next story is karma and Schadenfreude all rolled up into one. And it could be given the title of Jungle Justice. On April 17th, a man suspected of poaching rhinos at South Africa's Kruger National Park was killed by a herd of breeding elephants that he encountered while fleeing from park rangers. Managing executive Gareth Coleman praised the park's successful weekend in the fight to keep our rhinos alive, as rangers arrested five suspects carrying hunting rifles and an axe in a continuing crackdown on poaching. This isn't the first time the national park has had jungle justice. For bonus points, let me remind you of what happened back in 2019, when a skull and a pair of pants were all that remained of a suspected poacher killed by an elephant and eaten by lions in the park. Reminds me of the punchline for an old restaurant joke that goes, "Sometimes the bull wins." Yes. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's a story where the train to Normal has long since left the station. Please carefully follow along. 33-year-old Anna Marie Chidari of Boone, North Carolina, was sentenced March 31st in West Virginia to 40 years in prison after pleading guilty to second-degree murder, ending a case that McDowell County Assistant Prosecuting Attorney Denny Morgan called the craziest his office had ever seen. As I said, follow along. So Anna Marie had been arrested along with her father, 55-year-old Larry Paul McClure Sr. of Pendleton, Kentucky, and her sister, 31-year-old Amanda Michelle Naylor McClure, in connection with the 2019 murder of John Thomas McGuire, the 38-year-old boyfriend of Amanda McClure. Now, according to Morgan, McClure and his daughters tortured and killed McGuire on Valentine's Day 2019 and buried his body. Who says people aren't romantic anymore, huh? Later, convinced McGuire was still alive, they exhumed the body and drove a stake through it before dismembering and reburying it. Now, after they murdered the boyfriend, Amanda and Larry, her biological father, had sex several times. And 4 weeks later, married each other in Virginia. Larry McClure confessed to the murder after being arrested in Kentucky on unrelated charges. He pleaded guilty to first-degree murder and was sentenced to life without mercy. Amanda McClure pleaded guilty to second-degree murder and was sentenced to 40 years. Wow. Now there's a family that really knows how to get their freak flag flying. Yikes. It's like a scene out of Deliverance. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? NASA expert Rod Pyle is back with us. He's here to talk about the recent success NASA has had with their helicopter on Mars and what this means for the mission going forward. Rod is the author of more than a dozen books, including Destination Mars. He's also the editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, which is published by the National Space Society. And Rod joins us once again from California via Skype. Hi, Rod.
Hi there. Good to hear from you.
Nice to hear from you as well. Are you planning on updating the book Destination Mars now that there's a helicopter flying around there?
Well, that publisher is no longer with us, so probably not. But I've written a couple of articles, and just so it's said, Ad Astra, which you so kindly mentioned a few moments ago, we just did our special 2021 edition has just been released. It's all about living in space. And the reason I mention it is two things. It's 100 pages with only about 10 pages of ads, which makes it unique in the commercial magazine sector. And two, we're going to be on bookstore shelves across the country in about a week, which is a first for us. So
excellent.
That's pretty exciting. Yeah, it's up till now it's been for National Space Society members only, but we did some work, and so we're in bookstores and on all the digital platforms coming up. So there's plenty of news on the Perseverance mission in there. But yeah, what a moment, you know? I mean, all these years, and I kind of had my head in the Mars helicopter space since about 2014, all these years of anticipating, wondering, will it fly, will it not, will it work, will it not? I mean, they just make it look so damned easy, don't they?
Yeah, yeah. Well, what was your biggest concern? I'm sure you watched it live. What was your biggest concern, your biggest fear of what could possibly go wrong with that helicopter since you were so into it?
So the small fear was that it wouldn't get off the ground in the first couple of tries. And that turned out to be the case, only first try. But they had scheduled a jump on that previous Sunday. And they had a software timeout because I should back up a step. So they had dropped the helicopter off the floor of the rover, which was planned. And then they backed the rover away and drove up to this small knoll. And when, you know, it was an overlook, it was probably only 4 or 5 feet above the flat area, not very high, to watch the flight from the rover. So the rover would take video and the Mars helicopter would take images as well. So they conducted their first test because they want to be very careful. This is many tens of millions of dollars worth of hardware, just the helicopter alone, which seems pretty incredible when you look at how small and light it is. But, you know, that doesn't necessarily count anymore, right? And they spun up the blades. It's got two carbon fiber blades, about 4 foot diameter, that rotate in opposite directions. They spun them up. And in the transition from spin up to actually reaching flight speed, there was some kind of a software tumble. So it took about a week and a half to work that out. And then finally we all got to see the test flight. So my real fear was, would the thing land back on its legs? Because we went to a press conference in 2014 or 2015 down at Caltech, and Mimi Ong, who was the primary investigator on the project at the time, very nice lady, was talking about the helicopter. And these are pretty early days, so they were still figuring out an awful lot of stuff. And she said, you know, we're just starting to test these mock-ups in the vacuum chamber, because Mars is, for all practical purposes, a vacuum. It's about 1% the atmospheric density of Earth. And she said the problem has been getting this thing to land on its feet. So if anybody here has got a better idea for landing legs, you come up and let us know. And none of us did, so it flew pretty much as designed. But successfully.
Well, you know, Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down. People might have checked into that.
Yeah, and you're the second person to say that to me. And it did occur, you know, what if you just put a big, like, shell of carbon fiber rods around it with a weight? But none of us realized, of course, how wide the blades would have to be. So that didn't make sense. There is another program that a friend of mine is working on at JPL. His name's Pascal Lee. He's a planetary scientist for a Mars cave explorer that actually is encased in a sphere of little rods, and that would be jet powered and go bouncing down to caves and run around and look at things, then come back up. And that one doesn't care how it lands, but the Mars helicopter cares how it lands. Yeah.
So what does this mean now for Mars exploration going forward? Because the other big news, which kind of got lost because everyone was talking about the helicopter, was the idea of creating oxygen on Mars.
Yeah. So just to wrap up the helicopter, the big deal here, and they're only going to fly it twice more, and then, you know, the rover's got to drive on because their primary target is a dead river delta up northwest of where they are, and they can't take the helicopter with them because it's a one drop and done kind of thing. So they'll do two more flights and they'll drive away. But what it does show us, you know, is really an engineering experiment to see, okay, can we get a drone to fly on Mars? And if we can, later on, we can send drones along with rovers that are recoverable. And they could pop up and look at the terrain ahead and tell us where to drive and where some interesting targets might be in the rocks ahead and so forth. So that's really been very, very successful. And then, as you point out, we had this other incredibly successful experiment, which did get lost in the shuffle, called MOXIE, for Mars In Situ Oxygen Experiment, I think. also named after a rather flatulence-inducing soft drink of the old Rust Belt. I don't know if it's with us anymore or not, but this has been remarkable. So it's a guy, I wrote a story on this and had the good fortune to meet the principal investigator on this project. I think it was also about 2016, named Mike Hecht at Caltech JPL, and just the nicest guy. And you know, I met him at lunch and somebody said, oh, this is Mike. He's working on the Moxie experiment. And I said, oh, what's that? And so he explained it. And I was like, you know, my pulse increased and I'm sweating, you know, and if you did a CSI kind of zoom down into my brain, all the neurons were firing. Cause I thought, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard.
What you're saying is you would have needed oxygen
and he could have made it for me.
Yeah.
So it's a box about a foot on each border and it's mounted kind of down low on the rover's chassis, and it converts Martian atmosphere into small amounts of oxygen by breaking down carbon dioxide, which Mars has got lots of. So what, right? What's the big deal? Well, the big deal is in an hour or so, they made about enough oxygen for a human to breathe for 10 minutes. But NASA's, this was a test. This is just an experiment. So NASA plans to scale this up, send much larger units to Mars over the next decade or so. And you start manufacturing oxygen there. Well, a couple of things happen. One, when the first human crew gets there in 7, 10, 15, 20 years, there will be this enormous supply of tanked up oxygen sitting there. So they get to breathe it. They can extract water from it if they need to. And most importantly, it gives them an oxidizer to help them come home. Because for, I think, every 15 tons of fuel, you have to carry, I think, almost 30 or 35 tons of oxidizer. So if you don't have to drag all that to Mars and you can make it there, and tank up your rocket for the return trip home, you're in good shape. You just want to make sure it works before you get there. So that's the big payout there. It's pretty exciting.
Well, we're going to have to cut this short because at press time, we have just recently learned, at the time that we were recording this, of the passing of a certain pioneer in the Apollo world, and I wanted to get you to, you know, put your 2 cents worth on him. Michael Collins from Apollo 11 passed away at the age of 90. He's often been referred to as the forgotten astronaut. I like to refer to him as NASA's first Uber driver. What can you tell us about Michael Collins and any interaction you may have had with him?
So I only met him a few times, never for an extended period of time, but he was the most gracious and just naturally kind and engaging of any of the astronauts I think I met. I mean, a number of them are wonderful like that, but I have to say, especially given his stature, he was the guy you wanted to be paired up with at a dinner, you know, if possible. He was truly a raconteur. He enjoyed fine wine. He had kind of wound down his retirement by learning how to do beautiful watercolor paintings, which, of course, have all just increased in value by a factor of about 1,000 as of today, as these things will happen. He was a very gifted writer. He was one of the few astronauts that wrote his own books about his experiences without a co-author, because he could do it, you know. So he wrote an incredible book called Carrying the Fire, which, if you haven't read, I highly recommend it. And he was unusually among the test pilot, early astronaut crowd, very personally reflective in his books. You know, he would really write about, here, cue the reverb, feelings, right? Which is something that, you know, test pilots don't always talk about easily. So he's just amazingly accessible. And lest any of us forget or weren't there, his first mission was Gemini 10. Where he flew around the Earth for the better part of a week. This was the run-up to Apollo, so this is between Mercury and Apollo, and he did the first spacewalk we ever did with Ed White in 1965 was successful, but mainly he went out and just kind of drifted around. You know, we were just trying to catch up with the Russians at that point. Mike Collins did what I think was, it can fairly be said, the first successful spacewalk since that time, conducting a number of experiments and so forth. He did two of them on Gemini. Then, more famously, he flew as the command module pilot on Apollo 11. And you're right, you know, some people, you say Michael Collins, and they go, who? But you say Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong, and they go, oh, those guys walked on the moon. So Collins was in the third seat. He flew the command module around the moon while the other two guys went down and explored, but did have the virtue of being the first person in human history to be completely alone when he was on the far side of the moon out of radio contact. So just an amazing guy. And then after he left NASA, a couple of years after the Apollo mission, he went on to run the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. So an amazing career and a loss that will be keenly felt.
Yeah, absolutely. Rod, always a pleasure to have you on the program. You mentioned that Destination Mars, while you can still get it, the publisher is no longer around. Tell us again about Ad Astra, the magazine that's coming out, and where we can get it.
Okay, so let me just correct myself. Actually, the assets of that publisher, which is Prometheus Books, were acquired. So Destination Mars and the other ones are still, I think they're available, or that may be on backlist by now. But I mean, with any of these things, you go on Amazon or eBay, and you know, they're all over the place. And there's lots of them that are signed. They're not signed by me, but they say they are. So you can even get a signed edition, whether it's genuine or not, is another question. Ad Astra is available on all major digital platforms for either single issue buys or subscriptions, and will soon be in Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, and independent bookstores all across the country.
Rod, thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you. Let's do this again sooner so we can talk longer.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Thank you.
NASA expert Rod Pyle, author of Destination Mars. His other books include Space 2.0, How Private Spaceflight, a Resurgent NASA, and International Partners Are Creating a New Space Age. Now, you can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this program, which is show number 0611. And you'll find links to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his books directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at Patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship, or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Ross Hall from Dying Art, who makes some really creative caskets. Plus, Sean Tyler Foley, the author of The Power to Speak Naked. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way and much more in the Stuff File News Department here on a program that's heard everywhere on all of your devices. Plus, it's also heard on several fine radio stations like WLSL-LP-FM in Dade City, Florida, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, CKLU 96.7 FM in Sudbury, and CFMU in Hamilton. Thanks to all for listening in. Don't touch that dial. Let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Edward and Cheryl Patton of Lakeview, New York, tried for 3 years to identify who was throwing used paper coffee cups, some with cigarette butts inside, on their front yard nearly every night, but they could not get a good look at the minivan as it drove by. Edward began keeping records of the littering and collected the cups, eventually filling 10 garbage bags. They even installed a surveillance camera, but it wasn't until neighbors set up a stakeout and captured the license plate number that the mystery was finally solved. On October 18th, police set up their own stakeout and pulled over 76-year-old Larry Pope, a former co-worker of Cheryl's, whom she had had disagreements with in the past. Pope was charged with harassment and throwing refuse on the roadway. The Pattons said the littering has stopped since his arrest. Well, this is the classic case of someone who can really, really, really hold a grudge. But seriously, how petty do you have to be to do this every night for 3 years to a former coworker? Wow. And, you know, living in Canada, we try to downplay what the world sees as something stereotypically Canadian, but Every once in a while, a story comes up that just plays into it, like this one. TELUS, the Canadian telecommunications company, said about 900 customers in British Columbia lost internet service when beavers chewed through a fiber cable. TELUS said customers in Tumbler Ridge lost service at 4 a.m. and repair crews discovered beavers had chewed through an important fiber cable at multiple points. Liz Sove, a spokeswoman for TELUS, said it was a very bizarre and uniquely Canadian turn of events. Our team located a nearby dam, and it appears the beavers dug underground alongside the creek to reach our cable, which is buried about 3 feet underground and protected by 4.5-inch thick conduit. The beavers first chewed through the conduit before chewing through the cable in multiple locations. Repair crews captured photos showing pieces of TELUS equipment being used by the beavers to build their dams. Wow. The only thing that could have made this story more Canadian is if the RCMP were wearing their red serge dress uniform and they captured the beavers in the act and also noticed that they were also building their dam using Molson beer crates and old hockey sticks. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, bragging about participating in the U.S. Capitol riot is more likely to land you in handcuffs than on a date. Unfortunately, 50-year-old Robert Chapman apparently thought the latter for allegedly telling a potential date about participating in the January 6th incident while using the dating app Bumble. According to court filings, Chapman reportedly told a person he was trying to sweep off their feet that I did storm the Capitol and boasted that he had made it all the way to Statuary Hall. The person he was chatting it up with wasn't impressed by his admission. We are not a match, the unnamed love match replied. I suppose not, Chapman replied. The Bumble user Chapman was chatting with reported him to authorities on January 13th, which spawned an investigation that culminated in his arrest in Carmel, New York. Chapman is charged with 2 counts of knowingly entering or remaining in a restricted building without lawful authority and 2 counts of violent entry and disorderly conduct on Capitol grounds. Chapman was subsequently released on bail. After a virtual court appearance, he is barred from traveling to Washington, D.C., except for court proceedings. Chapman isn't the only person implicated through dating apps. Apps such as Bumble, Match, and Tinder have used images of people pictured in the U.S. Capitol during the riots to identify and suspend suspects' accounts, while its users helped identify people and pass along the evidence. You know, love is blind, and apparently also stupid. It's interesting how so many people on the very extreme right are being swiped left. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Ross Hall has a rather unusual business. He custom builds colorful coffins in New Zealand for a company called Dying Art. Recently, he made a coffin for his cousin, who passed away in February, that was a giant cream donut. Ross joins us via Skype from Auckland. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us.
Thanks for inviting me along.
I saw this story that was in the news recently because of the casket you made for your cousin, but this is not just a one-off. This is the type of thing you do. How did your company Dying Art start?
That's a very good question. So it all happened about 18 years ago when I was doing my will. And I got to the section on my will where it said, do you want to get cremated or do you want to get buried? So I took the little cremation box, and it was probably 10 minutes after I did that, I sort of went to myself, I don't really want to go out in a brown box. I think I've had a little bit more of a colourful life than that. So I thought a little bit about it, and I wrote in my will that I wanted a red box with flames on it, because I think I know where I'm going to end up. But it sort of resonated with me. And when I can't be the only person out there that wants something a little different on the way out. And I put some thought to it, and in the end I sort of put it aside because I thought, no, that's too crazy. Nobody would be into that. Anyway, 6 months later, it rose its head again, and I came into work and I sat down with my designers and I said, let's design 20 caskets. So that's what we did, and I made a little brochure up and I took off to the funeral directors around Auckland here in New Zealand. And as you can imagine, they sort of greeted me with one eyebrow lifted and rigorously shaking their head, you know, sort of, no, that's not going to work. And they were right. I mean, 18 years ago, it was probably just a little bit too far out. I mean, I remembered when I went to funerals with my mum and dad when I was a kid, it used to be the same six hymns that they'd sing, and it would be the same mahogany box with the chrome handles on it. So it was sort of a stuck fast in its ways. But in recent times, and I'm talking probably the last 5 to 8 years, we've seen a pretty radical change in funerals here in New Zealand. And now it's a celebration of life rather than a mourning of the dead. And
well, that's because it's we, the baby boomers, who are now dying, and we always knew how to party.
That's too true. So, I mean, of late we have been doing quite a few different caskets. As you mentioned before, I made the donut for my cousin, which was his wishes. He was a connoisseur of donuts, and he knew the best places in New Zealand to go and buy cream donuts from. And he pulled me aside about 2 weeks before he passed and went, "Make me a cream donut, cuzzy." So that's what I did for him.
Okay, so I want to bring that up because it's his wish. It's something you made. But, you know, in reality, a lot of times it is the surviving family who makes the final choice, regardless of what the deceased may or may not have wanted. So did you have to convince your cousin's family that, yes, he wanted the donut casket and I'm going to make it for him?
No, it was a really easy process for me because his wife was involved in that conversation between the three of us, and nobody else in his family knew what was going to happen. I was talking to one of the pallbearers, which was my cousin's son, actually, and he said to me, "Ross, it was just unbelievable. When we walked into that chapel," he said, "there was this Mexican wave of gasps and then laughter." And he said, "you know, Dad got the last laugh on everyone." And, I mean, it was that shock. My cousin was the greatest guy. And, you know, I mean, he would just love to shock you. And he did it right up to the very end. And that was him. That was exactly what he was about.
So besides your cousin's donut casket, what other types of caskets have you created? How many over the years would you say have you made?
Oh, we do around about 100 a year. So I would say I've done close on 1,000 or 1,200 different sorts of caskets. We have a standard range that we do, and then we have these a little bit more outrageous ones. One of the ones that I really enjoyed making was for a little six-year-old boy that unfortunately passed away of leukemia. And his mum had organized his funeral that she wanted him to be buried in his favorite pirate ship, which was Jake the Pirate. So she came in with a little plastic toy that was Jake the Pirate's ship and said, "make me one of these." So we made him a pirate ship. And the funeral was held at a school, and there was probably 300 or 400 people there, a lot of kids. And the one thing that she didn't want is she didn't want the kids to be shocked by seeing a coffin. So we made this fantastic pirate ship with sails and galleys and cannons, and it looked absolutely unbelievable. And at the end of the funeral, when the sausage rolls and the cakes came out, all the kids used that casket as their bench, and they all stood around this pirate ship. There was Coca-Cola spilt on it, and lemonade, and 7-Up, and there was food all over it. But that's what, you know, to his mum, that was exactly the send-off that she wanted to give him, and she didn't want the kids to be scared about it, you know. So that was a pretty cool one. We made a fire engine with a ladder and flashing lights and the headlights that flash on and off, and it's on wheels, and you actually roll it into the chapel. We've got a yacht, which has got a keel and a rudder, and it has rope handles on it. It has a mast that stands about 3.5 meters high with a mainsail and a jib, and it's all rigged. That's a statement in itself. There's just so many different caskets, you know. I mean, and I love being so involved in it, because people come to us with their most intimate moments and photographs that they want us to portray on those caskets, you know, because it's become so personalized. And it was funny, I was talking to some of our designers the other day about it, and we were just saying, by the time we've designed these caskets up for these people, we know them so well. We've been on a life journey with them, you know. So I mean, I love doing it. It's not my main business. My main business is the design and a signage company, but I just feel like I'm giving a little bit back to the world.
Now, give us an idea of the cost, and by that I mean, what does a standard casket go for from a usual funeral home supplier, and how does it compare to what you might be doing to a casket or with a casket?
Right, so a standard casket here is around about the $2,500 mark. My wrapped caskets work out at about $3,000 to $3,500, so they're not a heck of a lot dearer. But when you start talking about sort of yachts and fire engines and donuts and stuff like that, you're up around the $6,500-$7,000 mark. But there's a lot of people out there that want to spend that money on their loved ones, and I'm here to do it for them.
Would it also increase the cost of burial? And the reason why I say that is I would assume some of these caskets, just by their design, are larger or not exactly as rounded or as rectangular as a standard casket would be.
Yes, that's a very good question. The donut casket had a lot of polystyrene and shaping foam in it. My cousin was cremated. We didn't put that casket into the cremation just because of the toxicity that was in it. Most of our caskets come apart so that they can fit into a crematorium or into a burial. Jake the Pirate's casket, the sails folded down, the steering wheel folded down. It was made to the size to fit inside the crematorium. So we have to design around some of the restrictions that we've got. But you know, in saying that, when we do these caskets, we try our very hardest to be as environmentally friendly as possible. Our caskets are made from MDF, which is a product over here, which is basically the scrap bark that comes off trees when they mill them. And we also offer a range of a custom cardboard casket that we wrap with a vinyl, which is a non-PVC vinyl. So that breaks down as fast as what the cardboard does.
Now, I understand for your own funeral, from a story I read, for your own funeral, you want to be buried in a clear coffin wearing nothing but a leopard pattern G-string. Is that correct?
And on a white sheepskin rug.
And on a white sheepskin rug. Okay. I've got an issue with this. And the only issue I have is that, you know, I'm hoping that you live a long and fruitful life, and that you live well into the upper 90s, if not beyond. And if I were in your situation and this is the way I wanted to go, I'd be more concerned with constantly working out to live, to leave a good-looking corpse like that. I don't want to be a wrinkled old guy in a G-string in a clear casket. That's something I don't think anybody wants to see.
Oh, my kids have already told me they're not coming.
Do you sell any of the caskets beyond New Zealand, or is this something that is just indigenous to your country?
No, we sell all over the world. We have a special crate that we've had designed up, which is for the airlines to fit into planes. So we can ship all over the world. What we also do is we do urns which go with the caskets. Now, what we can do is we can do that same print on the urn, so it's that lasting memory, you know. But we've sent quite a few urns to the States. We have sent them to Canada. We've sent them to the UK. We've sent caskets to Australia. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, we'll get them anywhere you need them to be.
And people can find out more information by going to your website, which is dyingart.co.nz, correct?
That's correct.
Ross, thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much, Peter, for inviting me along. It was really great.
Ross Hall. From Dying Art, you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0611, and you'll find links to Ross's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
Listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. The best thing since sliced bread. No loafing here.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of The Power to Speak Naked. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. And I've got one more Stuff File news story to share with you here on a program that is also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. And that news story is a man in Nanaimo, BC, suffered serious lacerations to his hand after he poured gunpowder onto an open flame. According to the RCMP, he's lucky he didn't lose his hand. The incident happened after police received reports of an explosion in the backyard. Police learned that a group of men were around a fire and had an idea to pour gunpowder onto the open flame to see what the reaction would be. Well, now they know. The fire ran up the pouring gunpowder into the metal container in which it was being held, then exploded. Metal shards from the explosion ended up severely lacerating the man's hand who had been holding the container. He was taken to hospital, treated for his injuries, and released. Mounties believe that alcohol was a contributing factor to the incident. You figure? Said an RCMP spokesperson, they shouldn't be shocked with the results. When you mix alcohol with open fire and gunpowder. After the incident took place, RCMP say they noticed an illegal still for brewing alcohol in the backyard, which will now be dismantled. Police say no charges are being considered. See, This is why you take basic chemistry in high school, to prevent stupidity later in life. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Sean Tyler Foley has been an actor and performer for 35 years, and he's been a safety consultant, instructor, and keynote presenter for over 10 years. He's also the author of The Power to Speak Naked. Sean joins us via Skype from Calgary. Hi, Sean.
How are you doing, Peter?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. I am assuming at this very moment, because we are not using any cameras, that you are indeed fully clothed.
I am, in fact. I try to dress up for all of these because it's easier when I dress down later.
Actually, gotcha. So tell us about the book and why the title, The Power to Speak Naked, although I think I can guess, but why the title?
I want to know the guess first, because then I can tell you the title basis. So do tell me, what is your guess?
Because
what is your thought?
A lot of people always assume that, you know, if you're shy or afraid of speaking in public, that you're supposed to envision the audience being naked.
And you would be 1,000% correct, with that being the assumption of where the nexus of the title came from. And it's because I think that is the worst advice ever.
I agree.
I always find it incredible that everybody wants you to feel comfortable by picturing other people in discomfort, which is, I think, the basis of picturing your audience naked, because then they're in a more ridiculous situation than you. And I think it's bogus advice. And so the power to speak naked, it actually came about, I was putting the book together and we didn't have a title and I was waffling over them and some people were taught, and I asked in a group of friends one evening, and I said, you know, what's some of the advice that you guys have for speaking naked or for speaking? And they said, well, you know, picture the audience naked. And I went off on this rant about how it's the worst advice ever and that I would rather empower somebody to speak naked than have them picturing an audience naked, that they should have the power within themselves to speak naked. And all of a sudden everybody went, that's the title of the book. I went, so it is. And as we started to explore it, it's a couple of layers to it. So first of all, I want people to literally feel that they could confidently take the stage without any clothes. Like, on the surface text of it, I really do feel that you should be able to have confidence in yourself to go up and stand up naked. But that's very literal interpretation. What we really mean by that is to strip you down raw so that you don't need the PowerPoint, you don't need props, you don't need lighting, that you can just go and give a presentation because you are your own authority. So just speaking your raw naked truth and speaking without gimmicks. So those are the three layers. Being able to be authentically you and come up and expose yourself in a very vulnerable way with your presentations. Be able to do them without gimmicks, without adornment, without any unnecessary fluff. And then if you get really good, like me, actually be confident enough that if somebody challenged you, and somebody has, that I could, if I wanted to, go up and present without any clothes on and be completely comfortable doing it. Cold, but comfortable.
Well, obviously somebody works out. the thing I find interesting is the idea of the lack of confidence that some people have when it comes to public speaking. The reason why I bring that up, you're an actor. You've been an actor for a long time. And it's not unusual to hear actors or broadcasters like myself say, we are generally shy people. Mm-hmm. But we are very confident in what we do. So, for instance, I have been able to speak in front of a crowd of, say, 2,000 people in an auditorium when I'm doing my job. Mm-hmm. I have crumbled in front of a classroom of 15 school kids.
Yes.
Because I'm not doing my job. Mm-hmm. So it's a matter of the confidence level, not the crowd size.
Well, it is definitely that. And a lot of people, when they meet me, are often surprised when I tell them that I'm an introvert. And I am. The thing that I like the most about public speaking is it is the truest expression of an introvert, because I don't have to interact. I can present, I can be on stage, and I don't. It's a weird kind of, you know, the fourth wall where I have people. And which is funny, because in my presentations, I do elicit a lot of audience participation and feedback. I get people up and moving and doing things and talking amongst themselves. But I like it because I can direct the course of the conversation. I find small talk like small, intimate networking events, I find them incredibly stressful. I don't like having to make small talk. I don't like having to have that many interactions. I developed a really great networking technique so that I didn't have to do that, where I kind of do a quick pitch that magnetically draws people to me so that I don't have to go and be like, hi, what do you do? This is what I do, blah, blah, blah. Like, it just drives me insane. But a lot of that confidence to come up and take the stage is just knowing that you are the authority. If you've been asked to take a stage, it's because you knew something that somebody else didn't, that you have more knowledge than someone else. And it doesn't have to be that you're the expert on all things or even the expert in that thing. You just know more than the people you were presenting to and you were asked to be there. And when you can really step into that position of authority, and I love what you were talking about, right? An auditorium of 2,000 people can be really fun because it's so big that you don't know who you're talking to. Where, and I've been in the same position where you have a classroom of 15, particularly junior high students. Oh man, that's a tough crowd.
Yeah.
Like that, I sweat bullets for that one too. I don't get stage fright with it, but I'm like, how am I even going to keep your attention?
Absolutely. So, now you mentioned you're an introvert, which again, doesn't surprise me. And the idea that you've been an actor for quite a long time. And by the way, let's go through your IMDb.
Please do.
What would some things people would know you from? I know you've done Freddy versus Jason. You've done Cole Squad. What are some of the other things people would know you from?
The remake of Carrie is fun. If anybody is a fan of William H. Macy or Dame Helen Mirren, I did an incredible show with them called Door to Door. It's a biopic on an amazing man, Bill Porter, who recently passed away, had cerebral palsy and was one of the number one salesmen for the Watkins Group doing door-to-door sales. And his life story was phenomenal, and I was blessed to be able to be in a Golden Globe winning show with Golden Globe winning actress Dame Helen Mirren and William H. Macy. It was a phenomenal and fun show for me to do.
The reason why I bring up your acting is, again, you've been doing it for a long time, and is part of what you do when it comes to public speaking actually assuming a role?
A little bit of it is. So what it is I take on the character of Sean Tyler Foley. So in my private life, if you were to ask my wife who she's married to, she'll tell you she's married to Tyler. But when I take the stage, when I am, whether I'm performing or whether I'm giving a presentation or a keynote, I'm Sean Tyler Foley, author, actor, speaker. It is a persona. It's a little bit of bravado that I take on, and it's, you know, it's still me, but it's a larger hyped up version of me. And same when I was acting and performing.
I noticed you put author before actor.
Yes, because I am currently an author. I am formerly an actor. I'm semi-retired. My agent still phones every once in a while. I'll be out filming a small scene next, what is it, the 7th of May. I have a small little gig that I'm doing, but it's nothing that I actively pursue right now. It's definitely a hobby where speaking and the book and publishing is my current vocation of choice. It is what I do full time, and the acting is part time. So I am a speaker, author, actor.
Well, at least your agent is calling you. who exactly did you write the book for? And by that I mean, were you writing for people who need to be in public speaking, you know, CEOs and business people, or did you write it for the general population just to give them more confidence? Because the ideas that are espoused in your book are things that could be used in our daily lives.
Well, and it's I'm so glad you asked, because it's my ideal avatar for this is that person who is afraid to talk in the boardroom, and subsequently it's costing them. The fear of public speaking and presenting has a 10% reduction in your ability to earn. So whatever you're making right now, if you were confidently able to public speak, you would be making 10% more. So it has a 10% reduction in your wage, and it has a 15% impotence in you getting a promotion. So the public speaking is considered a leadership quality. And as soon as you're able to do it and feel comfortable doing it, you are more likely to be promoted, which further increases your ability to earn a wage. And that statistic crushes me because I have now given that statistic to your listeners, and statistically, only 8% of them are going to do anything to change that. The other 92% are going to be satisfied with their with going, no, I don't care how much more I can make. I'm never getting up to speak. And I think that's a shame. I think it's unfortunate because most people who think that they're afraid of public speaking actually are not. I would challenge anybody who tells me that they're afraid of public speaking, and I would say that you are not afraid of public speaking because you do it every day. We speak to people in public every day over the course of our daily interactions. But what people are afraid of is public judgment. And I think that's a very real fear. I think it has validity, but I think it's easily overcome.
I think it's interesting that most people say that they're afraid of doing things like a eulogy, and also people are afraid of death, which means people would rather be in the casket than do the eulogy, which I think is a weird situation all the way around. Your book, The Power to Speak Naked, where can people find your book?
It is being released September 7th. And I would absolutely love it if everybody went to barnesandnoble.com and pre-ordered the book. It would make my publisher happy, and it would make me happy.
Sean, thank you very much for being on the program with us. Pleasure to have you on.
Oh, it was my joy, Peter. Thank you so much.
Sean Tyler Foley, author of The Power to Speak Naked. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0611, and you'll find links to Sean's site, where you can then find all the information about his book. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
33-year-old Cordell Coleman was arrested for public intoxication on April 14th in Little Rock, Arkansas, and was held until about 2:30 the next morning, which would mean that by that time he had sobered up. When he was released from the Pulaski County Jail, Coleman took the first car he came across, an unmarked Little Rock Police Department SUV that had been left unlocked. Police tracked the car to an apartment complex about 10 miles away where Coleman was found in the car. He was brought back to jail and charged with felony theft, this time in lieu of $25,000 bond. Now, why, oh why, after getting released from jail, would you think it would be a good idea to steal a vehicle just outside said jail, when chances are most of those vehicles would be cop cars? One reason, and one reason only: you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0611. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links to all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0611. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including the podcast station, cyberstationusa.com, kdxradio.com, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, truetalkradio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, CKUW-FM in Winnipeg, and CFMU in Hamilton. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. A tape of the preceding program will be sent to the Radio Hall of Fame, where it will be placed under the statue of Marconi, which is kind of wobbly.